Today, anyone can, with just a semi-working laptop, can make a game from scratch and publish it to the whole world. So there's nothing really stopping anyone from doing stuff. Easier said than done, of course.
That's Jens Andersen from Villa Gorilla explaining why you really should just get started with making video games. But right now, you're listening to Player Characters. And if you're a fan of video games and you want to get a job that has something to do with games, this show is for you. Maybe you're thinking about becoming a YouTuber, a streamer, a producer, a journalist, or a game developer like today's guest, Jens. I want to help you do that. By the way, if you're enjoying Player Characters, please share it with your friends. And subscribe to the podcast. You can find it on Apple Podcasts or Stitcher. In this episode, I talked to Jens about how his career has taken him from AAA games and jobs in some very famous studios to a painting app and now releasing a quirky indie game with a very small team. It's quite clear that he loves making games and wants to be a part of as much of the process as possible. I'm Seventh Son, and I hope you will enjoy this episode of Player Characters. Hi Jens, welcome to Player Characters.
Hello.
My mission with this here podcast is to inspire people to get a job in video games, and that's I do that by talking to people who've already done that, gotten a job, that is. And whether that's developers, artists, journalists, country creators, or something else entirely, lots of possibilities. I think a lot of us have probably heard this idea that it takes 10,000 hours to get good at something, but with an industry and a media that is as young as video games, I think to myself, 10,000 hours of what exactly, and how can I get those 10,000 hours in before I start working? That seems impossible. And definitely, you cannot make 10,000 hours of YouTube videos before you start your YouTube channel. That's just impossible. And also because I like to hear all these stories, and it seems to me that a lot of the people working in it are actually self-made. So yeah, I like these stories. So why don't you tell me a little bit about yourself and what it is that you do?
Sure. I'm a game developer. I'm mostly a designer / programmer. Started off programming, worked in big games, AAA stuff. Nowadays working small games. Our team is 3 right now. And love making all kinds of games, mostly from a technical programming side. But the whole shebang, really, from conception to launch, I love it all.
Okay, well, let's get into it then. I have to ask this because this is the first question I always ask my guests. What is your first memory of gaming?
That is a hard one. It's one of two. I don't remember which order. Either it was my, like, when I was 7 years old or something, a friend having like one of those first gaming consoles. Maybe it was Pong, or maybe it was some other super crappy video game, but super fascinating anyhow. But I think the more important one was when my father brought home a computer to do bookkeeping on, and he had this how to program basic book that came along, and it had some video game-ish stuff on it. You could type the basic program and stuff to get video games. So sort of starting off having to write the games before you could play them.
Well, that's I'm not judging, but that's old. That's the very, 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 very beginning, where Pong, that's sort of like the first video game of all time.
Yeah,
and I gotta say, I'm a little starstruck here, actually, because you're so modest. You've worked at a lot of really big places, and the game that you have out right now is just getting rave reviews all over the place. And I love it myself. I've played it a lot, and I'm super happy to talk to you about these things. The game is called Yoko's Island Express, of course, and it's a gem. Really, absolutely fascinating thing.
Thank you very much.
Yeah.
But, I'm glad you like it.
Yeah. But let's go back, and then after you then played around with your dad's computer, how did you get started working with games on a more serious level?
Yeah, that's like throughout my whole childhood, I obviously played video games. I did a lot of programming. I joined the demo scene here in Scandinavia, doing like these visual art presentations. Did some programming and just enjoyed the community that was like super strong here in Scandinavia. And got to know a bunch of people from there, and that sort of got me to be a friend with Magnus Högdahl, who was one of the guys who he founded Starbreeze. But before that, he was one half of the Triton demo group, and he made Fast Tracker 2, which some people remember fondly, a music making tool. And he was setting up a new studio after having crashed his first one, doing a sort of cult, never released game called Into the Shadows. But anyway, he was setting up a new studio, and I knew him, and he asked me if I wanted to help out, and I helped out some, and then he offered me a job. And that was just the conception of Starbreeze, basically.
You didn't go to school before that? Or?
No, so there was no schools. Again, I'm too old, I guess. When I left high school, I have a hard time translating those, but doing gymnasium in Sweden, when you turn 18, about, you get to pick sort of the what kind of school you want to go to. And they had science, but they didn't have computer science at the time. Or actually, they just got it. They, in two locations in Sweden, they set up a branch for computer science. So I moved across Sweden. And went to this school in Uddevalla. It was a very general computer science thing for 2 years.
Okay.
But nothing game related and not very advanced. But again, doing demos and stuff like that was the real education. Like, it was a big community, lots of people to learn from, and the stuff we did is so close to video games anyway. So yeah, but self-taught, I would say.
So you're a programmer then, but also you're a game designer then?
Yeah, so like, programming is easy, designing is hard. At least for me. Like, you mentioned the 10,000 hours, and I absolutely got those 10,000 hours in before I started working in the video games industry for programming. And maybe now I have 10,000 hours of design as well. I don't know. But anyway, like, starting at Starbreeze, it was like we were like six people or so. I was programmer number two. We had level designers, we have an animator, some artists, but we didn't have dedicated designers, so we sort of helped out on that stuff altogether. As the company grew, it became clear that we needed more dedicated design, sort of high-level design. And I wanted to be a part of that, so I more and more transitioned into that. So, like, the first game we did there crashed. Like, it got cancelled by the publisher who financed it. The second one, I don't think too many people have heard about, was Enclave. And that's, you know, as chaotic as game development gets. We, after our first project got cancelled, we had no money into the company whatsoever. So we, all of us, went down to the unemployment office the day after the project was canceled and said, hey, we don't have any money. We need to register here, I guess, to sort of get unemployment benefits. We have an idea of doing a new game. Can we do that in the meantime? And since there weren't very many jobs, they were very supportive. And it's like, yeah, work on that stuff. And you can do these courses, like how to look for a job courses in the meantime. So for 6 months, we were sort of funded by the unemployment office. And then we got signed with a publisher for Enclave. To do a first-person steampunk shooter for PC,
mm-hmm.
heavily inspired by Quake at the time.
Yeah.
So we shipped that game about a year and a half later, and at that point it instead was a third-person hack-and-slash game for a console, so it sort of transitioned a little bit during that time.
Yeah.
But that was the first game out, and sort of that's how we learned how to make video games.
Mm.
And then we started working on Chronicles of Riddick after that.
So Chronicles of Riddick obviously was also a movie with Vin Diesel in it. Mm-hmm. So how did that collaboration come about? Was the game out first, and was this just its own IP, or I don't know the story about that.
No, it's kind of interesting because, like, at the time and still, I guess movie-based games are normally terrible, and that's mostly because, at least in my opinion, because the turnaround of making a movie is usually quite short. From sort of when they green light the movie and have it out, it's about a year sometimes for like these big productions. Chronicles of Riddick was sort of a weird setup. Like, the salespeople at Starbreeze had really good relations with Universal, who owned the IP, and Pitch Black, which was sort of the prequel to Chronicles of Riddick, had become a cult movie, and Vin Diesel and David Tuite, who's the director, knew they wanted to make something more. So Universal sort of bet on that would happen before the whole movie was even greenlit. So we actually got 18 months, I think, to work on that game. And when we started, there was no Chronicles of Riddick. There was only Pitch Black. So we had to do something very separate from the movie. Like, we got to see the movie script for Chronicles of Riddick about halfway through production. So obviously we had to have made a lot of decisions before even knowing what the movie was about. And I think that's a good idea anyway. You don't want to complicate things by trying to tell the same story anyway.
Mm.
So yeah, like, we pitched what we wanted to do with the IP, and they liked it, and they wanted to do the movie, and the movie got greenlit, and everything just moved along there.
Mm.
Sort of, until Starbreeze almost went bankrupt at the end. Because we had, Starbreeze at the time had three projects going. One was the sequel to Enclave, Enclave 2, and the other was Knights of the Temple. And they had the same publisher, and that publisher went bankrupt, so suddenly two-thirds of the income to the studio disappeared overnight, pretty much.
Oh.
Knights of the Temple managed to get released, but still, and Chronicles of Riddick was it wasn't in a great position either. Like, it was coming in really hot. So we needed more money for that, and we were like 100 people at the studio at the time, and so we had to start letting go people. So while we were crunching to finish Chronicles of Riddick, we went from about 100 to 25 people.
Yeah, that's brutal.
That was super brutal, and we just had to focus on making the game, but it was really harsh.
Yeah. But like you said, it's actually mentioned as one of the few times that this whole marriage between a game and a movie went well. So you can be proud of that, definitely.
Yeah, the game turned out fantastic. We were like super lucky in many ways of how like it looked like shit 6 months before it was released. Nothing worked, and it looked really ugly. And then suddenly we were out there with the first game with like full-blown normal mapping and dynamic lighting out there and interesting genre blending gameplay and like super underdog. So people loved finding that game and like, wow, what is this?
Mm.
The only downside was that the movie completely tanked. So the IP wasn't very hot.
No. Yeah, actually, if I remember correctly, Vin Diesel, he's so invested in this IP, in this universe, so he basically bankrolled a third film himself. It's just called Riddick, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, I'm not sure. Like, there is a third movie. Yeah, it's Riddick. I kind of like that movie. I'm not sure how it came about, but, you know, the IP is perfectly fine. I think, like, the Chronicles of Riddick movie was maybe too much of a space opera. Like too epic when the IP is really the character. Like the Riddick character worked really well as a game character as well. Like doing this sort of corny but cool one-liners, but not like it's not this really complicated character that the player has to burn my shoulder. It's like it's a very easy to understand character to play as a player.
and
also like escape being the prime objective in the game, at least. It was really nice.
So, and then you mentioned you actually left Starbreeze. Why did you leave?
Yeah, we did. So after Riddick we did Darkness as well, and that was a really long production. And once Darkness was sort of coming to an end, we started talking about what project would be next, and we have some really exciting stuff coming up, started working on prototyping and stuff. But at that point, it became clear that it would be one more very similar kind of project, like this cinematic first-person action-adventure. And I guess I wasn't really ready to spend another 3 years on something like that. Also, like the production values kept rising, and there are a couple of like big thoughts that made me sort of not want to do that. One was like, when you're working on a team that big, on a project that big, like your individual contribution is not that. You can't even if you are like lead designer, which I was on the Darkness, you can't really control the outcome of the game to such a large extent. There are so many external factors that decides if it's going to be a good game or not. So it's kind of a risk. So that's one. The other was it takes so long. Like I wanted to do many more things. Well, we can talk more about that later, but I was sort of believing that if I did smaller projects, I could do more of them. And then like the third big thing is when you work on those kind of realistic rendering AAA games, you spend so much time just reaching the bar of the what looks good on screen. Like you spend 95% of the time on just making it be nice without really doing something unique. And I rather spend time on what's unique about what I'm working on than trying to get this kind of production in shape. So anyway, I went on a sabbatical and moved with my girlfriend, now wife, who got into art school in a different city in Sweden and started doing prototypes and indie stuff, I guess. Like, the word indie wasn't really used at that point, but that's what I was doing.
Yeah. But then you got a call from somebody that you couldn't say no to, I'm guessing.
Yeah, so I spent a year and a half or something doing prototypes. One really important thing that I did was did a painting app for the Nintendo DS called Colors.
Oh, wow.
A homebrew thing that I put out there, and that proved really successful, at least for the limited demographics of people who had flat cards for their DS and did homebrew. But a really nice painting app for it that I came to build on later on. I sort of realized during that time as well that it wasn't that too much fun just working on your own. And then, I got a call from LucasArts asking me if I wanted to go there.
That must have been surreal.
Yeah, I guess. Well, sort of. Like, Darkness did really well critically as well, and did stuff that was sort of... we pushed the bar on narrative, I think, in video game, like interactive storytelling and stuff. And that was really something that I think a lot of studios were trying to grasp and improve and experiment more with. So I think most of the core people on the Darkness team got a lot of offers for working at various studios. But like the reasons I left working on AAA hadn't really changed. But Lucas all felt like an exception. Yeah, no, growing up, I played a lot of the LucasArts stuff, like Maniac Mansion, Monkey Island, Dave the Tentacle. Those are some of my favorite games. And I really love that stuff. And also, I always wanted to work abroad. And having visited San Francisco, that felt like an ideal city to live in. So, sort of understanding that I was kind of tired of working on my own and not working on a team, I took the leap and accepted the job as lead designer on the Indiana Jones title that had been in development for a long time. However, 2 weeks later, they call me up again and tell me that they've canceled the project. So that was weird.
Yeah.
But they still had a role for me there, working on a smaller team, so that actually fit what I really wanted to do almost better. So they had a 20-man team doing experimental, like trying to develop new IP and release it in the now popular Xbox Live Arcade store. I moved over there and started working at LucasArts, and that was kind of cool.
It's interesting that you say this, because I think that's one of the things that I'm wondering, and maybe some other people are, that is, why don't these huge developers spend, or as companies, that is, why don't they spend a little portion of the money to just, develop small indie titles or experiment more? And it's good to hear from you that they actually do that. Maybe we're not seeing that so often on the other end, perhaps. But it because
they try, I guess. We have the same interest even back at Starbreeze. Like Starbreeze, when I was working there, was a work for hire studio, meaning that all income came as an advance from publishers, sort of funding the development of the game. Yeah. And that's kind of a precarious situation, and not necessarily a situation that a lot of studios want to be in.
No.
Because when the game is done, you need to start working on another game right away. And that can be hard especially if your previous games didn't do fantastically well.
Yeah.
And there's always going to be an overlap. People are tired. They want to have a break, and it takes time to sign a new contract. So doing smaller projects seems like a potential way out.
Yeah.
From the work for hire cycle. However, when we discussed it and talked about it, it became very hard for a studio that's set up to do big productions.
Mm.
Like everything is sort of built to build. There's so much overhead to support big teams. And you actually get quite a bit of money for every person spend working on a big project.
Yeah.
And when you start to budget the small project, it becomes very expensive very quickly, and you can't compete with sort of people sitting in their garage or sitting at home doing stuff, like spending year after year just doing stuff.
No, of course not.
It's hard. So, but I think pretty much every big publisher experimented with this. Trying to do smaller titles within this kind of big studio mentality, and LucasArts did that as well. But I think Ubisoft is sort of successful doing it, but the rest pretty much failed.
Yeah, Ubisoft has a handful of titles like that. You really look into it, you can see a couple of those. But also EA, for instance, they have Unravel. It's also Swedish, yeah. Is it not?
So EA is a special case because EA Originals, because they don't need to profit from the games, like they are doing it more as a goodwill kind of thing.
Ah, okay.
So it doesn't really matter, like, they fund indie developers rather than develop it in-house.
Yeah.
And the goal is not to make money.
No.
Very few companies can afford to think like that. But yeah, there are a couple of games that, you know, developed under this thing. But it turns out to be really hard in bigger companies as well to be nimble, to be lean.
Yeah.
Because there's approvals, there is all this kind of red tape and everything. Like just doing, using the QA services is much more expensive than like playing fast and loose with that stuff and get it out there. Anyway, for LucasArts, it was a really nice team. We did some really cool stuff, but quite, like, we only got to do work on that for 6 months or so before they sort of realized that this wasn't getting to what they needed, which what they wanted to do was find, like, a new big IP they could build a AAA game on, or movies or whatever.
Mm.
And indie stuff is super rare to sort of set up for that. I guess you have like the modding stuff has more potential with the Arma Fortnite kind of thing. Well, Fortnite is not a mod, but very few indie games can scale in that way, and that's sort of what people realized, and the whole project got shut down.
Yeah. Okay. So then you came home to Sweden?
No, not really. So I stayed at LucasArts for a bit and helped out on the Force Unleashed 2 and some stuff like that. And I actually made a final stab at setting up a AAA project there for a while.
Okay. But
LucasArts was, like, while it was a fantastic place to work at, it was kind of dysfunctional in terms of how you build games there. Too many points where things needed to be decided before even getting to what game you were making. Yeah. So I kind of gave up on that and instead left LucasArts and founded my own company called Collecting Smiles. And then I picked up this kind of painting app that I did before. And now the 3DS, Nintendo 3DS, was just released. I made a commercial product of that.
Okay.
Which turned out fantastic. It sold really well. It got fantastic reviews and made me really happy because I it was fun because I did the whole thing. It was kind of an experiment to do the whole thing on my own as well. I did all the development. I had, you know, some friend doing QA. I had another friend doing the user interface, but the rest was all me. I had did all the PR with some. I had a lot of friends around me there in San Francisco that I could ask for advice.
Mm-hmm.
But I, you know, did the whole publishing bit myself as well, which was very interesting and very educational and very hard. Releasing a game is really hard.
Yeah.
It was super successful. And then I got my first son, and that's when I decided to move back.
Okay.
I didn't want to raise an American, right?
No.
No, but I wanted to be closer to family, so me and my wife moved back, and again, work doing stuff on my own is not as fun as doing stuff with a team, so I started talking to an old colleague from Starbreeze about who also had been on a sabbatical thingy, moving back to Sweden, so we decided to found a new studio called Villa Gorilla. Here in Stockholm.
Yeah.
And that was 5 years ago.
Yeah, and then you spent a lot of time on one game anyway, even though you wanted to make games fast.
Exactly. So that was the sort of the lesson. You can't make stuff fast. I can't make stuff fast. I'm sure people can. I suck at making stuff fast.
Mm.
It takes a lot of time. So that was also something I guess I learned at LucasArts when we were trying to do short projects, new IP and everything. It's like a lot of your ideas suck, so you need to try them and then discard them and try something else.
Mm.
Even if you like have a cool concept or anything, it still takes a lot of time to iron out everything that goes around it. Mm. And well, it shouldn't have to take 5 years, which Yoko's Island Express did. But it does take years to make a good game, I think.
Yeah.
At least the way I work.
I
really like to work iteratively, like get something up and running and then just build on top of that. And not worry so much about like fleshing out the concepts before I try it, but sort of let the game itself drive its own direction.
Yeah, good stuff takes time. that's quite interesting, actually.
Yeah, no, absolutely, and that's also like why I decided to that smaller teams are so much more fun than bigger teams. Like when you work on a team about 100 people, all you do is sit around and talk about what you're supposed to do. The actual time you get to spend actually doing that stuff is such a small portion of the day. And I actually like doing stuff very much.
Mm.
So the smaller the team, the more stuff you get to do.
Yeah.
Rather than talking about doing it. And that's kind of the same thing, like throwing more people at the problem, then you move sort of the overhead to coordination and sort of information sharing and all that kind of stuff, and that's fine, and some people like that, but I rather have the game show the direction, like rather than trying to convince my teammates about that an idea is great, show that in the game instead. And sometimes it's not a great idea, and then then you find that out without embarrassing yourself. So now it's that's my favorite part of making video games is sort of have an idea, try it out, tune it, and then you have like then you sort of know and learn and understand if it's a good idea or not, and you get better at it.
Mm. But that must be sort of the trap or the difficult part. I mean, the more people that are there to see your thing before it's done, the you get more feedback and you have more ideas. And the fewer people you are, you have to be very certain that your idea is working. If like you don't have so much feedback, I'm guessing.
Well, you can have as much feedback as you want, and you should have a lot of feedback. Like obviously, you need to have something to show to get feedback on, and you need to get it to a state where it's not the obvious stuff that people react to anymore. It needs to look pretty enough, and it needs to play, like, it needs to work well, and then you can start getting feedback. But for Yoko, for example, we did a ton of playtesting. Like, the game was up and running in a couple of weeks, like, basic pinball stuff.
Yeah.
And at that point, we could hand it to other people and have them try it. And general pinball stuff wasn't that interesting to test on, but as soon as we started trying new stuff, expanding the playing field, it became really important to do that for us. And there's so much stuff that you can't figure out yourself because you're so close to it. You're too good at it, or you are sort of have your tunnel vision.
Mm.
And like for us, that was kind of easy because we shared offices with another game studio called Arrowhead.
Ah.
So these guys were super generous and offered us a corner in their office.
Mm.
And also we could use those people as playtesters. So we did that every week.
I've noticed that the people, the guests that I've had, they sort of mentioned that there's not so much competition in the games industry amongst developers. There's sort of a feeling that, well, if you help us with our game, we can help you with your game. And even though we might be competitors in some way, mm-hmm. we don't see it as much. Like it's better to get the help and get a better product yourself than just say we need
And even more than that, like people help out without expecting anything in return because they know the struggle. Like maybe some people helped them when they were, you know, new in game development, and a lot of, especially here in Stockholm, there are a lot of successful video game developers that have their financials sorted out, and like they just want to give back. So there's a lot of this kind of incubation style stuff going on.
Mm.
For example, have you heard about Stugan?
Maybe, I'm not sure.
So Stugan is sort of, I guess you could call it an incubator. A bunch of really seasoned game developers here in Sweden got together and started this almost like an artist in residency. It's out in the woods in the middle of Sweden. They have this kind of setup where they bring in 20 people or something from all over the world and that get to sit there for 6 weeks. And then they have people coming in. I'm a mentor there, so I go there every year, and I sit with each of the teams, and some of them are experienced, some of them are not so experienced, and they do all these kinds of different things. But they get feedback on their stuff, and different people with different specialties come in, like you have sound designers coming in, helping them with that stuff. It's a really cool thing, and it's all just to give back from the founders. And there's a lot of that kind of stuff going on with people just wanting to help other developers because it's fun and it feels meaningful.
Mm.
And like you were asking why there isn't any competition. Well, it's like games are targeting a global audience.
Yeah.
You are not really, like, sure, Battlefield is competing with Call of Duty. Like, it's very few, very specific games that are competing. The rest are sort of taking a small slice of the big pie. So it doesn't hurt.
No.
And there's usually a lot of good synergies. Just being inspired what other people are doing. People are doing things in different ways. You learn from your peers, right?
Mm.
So it's a really nice community, all over the world, I guess, but definitely here in Stockholm.
Yeah, I normally ask people if they have anybody to ask for help if they run into problems. But you've sort of said that both in San Francisco and here in Stockholm, you ask other developers, and there's even this Stugan that you said that is sort of formalized, but. Are there any other, or maybe I should say, do you actively seek out like forums or groups or something to talk to colleagues, or is it just more, I don't know, organically?
Yeah, I guess I have a bunch of friends that I can ask for specific stuff. No, I don't think I use any kind of forums. Like, I read a lot on Stack Overflow and stuff, of course. Google is your friend, but no, I'm not active in any kind of community or stuff like that.
No.
I guess I have a big enough network. If there's anything I need, I can, you know, find the right person to that knows about that stuff.
Mm. So, are there anybody in games development that you admire?
So many. Everyone I work with, almost. Like, there are so many talented people throughout. Like, I don't know. It's so hard. Like, I know I had my idols when I grew up, like David Braben, who did Elite,
yeah.
and those games, like managing to build this entire galaxy on a floppy disk. Sid Meier for the Civilization series, like all these kind of famous game designers, and I guess especially the technical game designers, because I sort of feel I can relate to them. But there are just, like, anyone who who ships a game is a hero, right? It's really hard. It takes a lot of effort, and like every person who ships a game of this caliber is doing it for, like, it takes so much effort and so much passion, and it shows when you play the game. And that's why it's so fun as well to meet game developers and speak to game developers. It's all coming from passion. So anytime, like, you go to GDC or anything like that, it's always the most fun you have is when you meet other game developers and just talk about making video games, because it just spills over the passion of what they are doing and how they are doing it.
Yeah. So you do go to GDC like on purpose.
On purpose. Yeah. Well, yes, I try. Well, especially GDC because it's in San Francisco and I used to live there. So it's fun going back there, but no, I do like going to conventions. I usually have a reason to go. But the fun part is just meeting the various people there.
Okay.
And even Stugan for me, I mentioned I'm a mentor there. It's super inspiring to just go there and talk to all these kind of people, like doing different things. It's just so fun, and inspiring to see what they are thinking and how they are working.
Yeah. So can you do this your whole life?
Yes, that's an easy answer. No, I feel, you know, I'm very certain because it's something I've considered. Is this something I want to keep doing for as long as I can imagine? Definitely. Like, ask any game designer and they'll tell you that they have 100 times more ideas than they can actually develop. So you just pick the best one at the time when you need to pick a new project, and then you work on that. But that still means that there are 99 ideas that you wanted to try out that you won't have time to try out.
Yeah.
So unless I get a lot of more time to and run out of ideas, I won't get bored anytime soon.
No. It just... It seems like that is also a shifting medium. I'm guessing that there are probably somebody out there who's working on a mobile right now thinking, oh, maybe we should not be doing this, or, you know, all of a sudden everything is a battle royale, or like there are these shifts. Nobody really makes or plays RTSs anymore. And I was thinking, is there a possibility that like your style of games is sort of just obsolete, and you're an old man making something that nobody likes, right?
Let's hope so. When I'm 70 years old and making my quirky single player 2-hour experiences or whatever, other people playing it will also be 70 years old.
Yeah, see, that's a possibility.
No, I don't think there's any risk of sort of being marginalized, I guess, is the word for what you're doing. Like, the games medium is so wide, and at least my excitement for, like, there's a lot of different stuff I would like to try. I don't think anyone who's making Battle Royale games feel that I can only do Battle Royale games.
No, probably
that's my calling. And even if they thought so, there's going to be a market for Battle Royale games forever in some ways, because like there's even a market for RTS games still, like, and not even a small one. Like, you just need to sort of adapt to what does an RTS game look like today. And make it in a, find a way to make that game. Like, maybe you need to make it cheaper or better or different. There's so many good games to be made still.
Yeah. But what if you had to do something completely different? What would that be?
Yeah, I've thought about that too. I have no idea. Like software development in general is fun enough, I guess. It's like making video games but removing the creative part. Making apps or whatever, yeah, fine. Not making software, that's harder. I guess I'd start making hardware, start building robots or something. But making robots, the stuff that excites me there is software anyway, so I'm not sure. Sort of, it becomes hard. Maybe become a clocksmith or something.
It's funny, now you've mentioned a couple of times that you consider yourself a technical developer, but when I look at Yoko's Island Express, I see a sort of artsy indie game. No pun, I don't mean to insult you, but it doesn't look like a technical marvel. It's way more of a beautiful game, a fun experience. There's a world there with life and the music and the gameplay elements and a very fresh take on the Metroidvania, all stuff that feels more creative than technical to me.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Like, I didn't mean to like, it's not a technological showcase in any way.
Oh,
like, I wrote the engine for it, so it was a very technical job for me to do. But like, the design stuff is definitely the creative aspect of it, and that's what's interesting about the game. The tech is not interesting, it's just working kind of thing. But yeah, absolutely, that's like, it's the creative part that's the interesting, and that's also why I said, like, the programming is the easy part, the game design is the hard part, because that's where you can really push the like, there's so much different stuff you can do there. There's so much untried stuff you can do there, and that's what we did with Yoko a little bit. Like, what would an open world pinball game look like? How would it work? We didn't know when we started. We had to find out by building it. And then also, like, building worlds is also one of the things I really enjoy by making games. Like, it's definitely a world in Yoko, like, had this tropical island, and we spend a lot of time talking about the different parts of the island, how they are interconnected, how they should feel, how they should work, how they should look. But, of course, all kudos needs to go to Matthias Nygg for making it look like that. Mm-hmm. Like, he, my business partner at Villa Gorilla, he's the one that made it real in terms of like look some like something.
Mm.
But yeah, it's definitely like you can call it artsy, I guess. It's definitely a very beautiful game, I think.
Yeah,
with a really interesting game mechanic.
Mm. Yeah, it's and like and the reason why I call it artsy is because even though. It's a dense world, I'd say, but there are like very obviously shifts in the style on, and the environment. So it's almost like a puzzle. You can see, oh, here's the underground area, and here's the beach mm-hmm. area, and here's the snow area, and that is a very deliberate shift from an environment to environment. So there's definitely someone who's been like. Doing a lot of artsy stuff and wanting to like play with the whole palette, and I'm not saying that is a bad thing, but
yeah, but that's the game design thing definitely as well. Like having getting the different environments to feel different, like the music changes, the game mechanic elements we use changes as well. Like it needs to feel like a new interesting place when you get to it as well, and. Mm. Yeah, we need to decide fairly early on sort of the various styles of environments. But it's very much an iterative process, like deciding to use Yellowstone, for example, as an inspiration for the steamy, the hot springs areas.
Yeah.
And that inspired, like, when we talked to our musician, Jesse Harlan, about that, and he got this kind of whole idea with guitars playing and like, everything feeds back into itself, and then like level designer Linus Larsson, who did all the level design, started experimenting with geysers and how that could impact gameplay, and everything needs to work together for it to be really nice. And that's also why it takes so much time, because like you put one piece in there and it sort of changes things, and everyone gets inspired by it.
Yeah,
and you just iterate.
Yeah. So, do you have any advice for people who would like to get into making video games?
Well, start making video games is the easy advice. Like, everything, it's kind of fascinating, I think. I guess it's like music. All the tools are sort of readily available nowadays. It didn't used to be that case, but today, anyone can, with just a semi-working laptop, can make a game from scratch and publish it to the whole world. So there's nothing really stopping anyone from doing stuff. Easier said than done, of course. But secondly, there's a lot of good gaming schools out there nowadays.
Oh.
At least here in Sweden, they are fantastic. And it works differently in every country, so it kind of depends on where you are.
Mm.
Where you're from, but if you're here in Sweden, we have some fantastic gaming schools, like 2-year programs, where you actually get to make games for 2 years, and then you get to intern at one of the big studios here. So it's a fantastic way to learn how to make games, how to work in a team, understand the games industry, all that kind of things.
Yeah,
I guess you have. I think you have similar schools in Denmark, right?
Yeah, we have a couple of schools in different areas, some 3D graphics and stuff. And there's also like a whole like university line that is more about the like the I wouldn't say the philosophical part of it, but like looking at games development from a university angle discussing it on that level, of course.
Yeah, it's interesting. Like the gaming schools here are separate from the universities, though. Like universities are good at training programmers, I guess, but not necessarily good at training game developers, like all the other disciplines. because the universities are, they have a sort of strict structure, rigorous structure.
Mm.
So you don't really need to spend the time actually getting experience in building products. So I guess you need to build products is how you start making video games. Do the full cycle, just making a model. Sure, if you build a kick-ass portfolio, I'm sure you can get a job in the games industry, but it's actually better to build stuff for actual game. It's worth a lot more, I think.
Mm.
And I'm sure there are lots of indie communities and stuff out there as well that is looking for help and like getting together and helping each other out.
Yeah. Are there any games that you wish that you had worked on?
Of course. Like all of my favorite games. I have so many of them though. Like I made a list a few years ago of my favorite I should say most inspirational games of all time. Mm-hmm. And it was so hard to narrow down that list. So I had to narrow it down to like 5 games in each category, like each genre.
Yeah.
I guess like the most influential game for me in this millennia though was Demon's Souls.
Yeah.
Which really had a tremendous impact on me as a game designer. And turns out I'm not alone. Everyone got inspired by that game.
Yes.
But it was very much an eye-opener for me on what you can and what you can't do and the benefit of breaking the conventions.
Mm.
It would have been cool to work on that game to understand how that came to be.
Yeah. So, if we talk about what you've done, what's your proudest achievement?
Well, it's 2 things, I guess. Like, Riddick, when we released that, was such a pleasure to release because it's got 90% on Metacritic, and we managed to be first in getting something that looked fantastic with the technology. We actually were really scared of the competition at the time. With Doom 3 and Half-Life 2 was sort of scheduled to be released at the same time.
Mm.
And those were really impressive games. But they both got delayed, so we managed to sneak out before them. And that felt really good because we got to show something that people hadn't seen before.
Mm.
So that was super cool. But also Colors, I think, my painting app, partly because it feels like it was all me. It's one thing to be part of a big team to make something great. It's a different thing to do something really good on your own. It felt really good because I knew it was my project, my baby. And also, I'm really proud of that one because it has, I have heard a lot of stories about people using it and becoming really affected by it. People in hospital beds getting to paint again. I have a friend that sort of reconnected with his father on his deathbed kind of thing when he was at the hospital and being there and doing portraits of his father. These super emotional situations that I almost feel like I can be a part of for enabling it.
Mm.
Really cool stuff like that. So that makes me really proud, of course.
Yeah, I can see that. Well, Jens, I want to be respectful of your time. So I just want to ask, are there any social media links that we can point people to if they want to say hello? Or
Hit me up on Twitter, Lerd, LLERD.
Uh-huh.
And I'll answer.
Okay. Do you have any other parting thoughts to the listeners? Something you want to ask of them?
No, not really. Make video games. I want to play them. Make new weird ideas. Bring the medium forward.
Well, that is no small ask, I'd say.
No small ask, yeah.
See if you could come up with something that is more weird than a pinball open world game.
Yeah, it doesn't have to be weird, but do cool stuff. And yeah. It doesn't have to be big or beautiful. Just do stuff.
Yeah. Okay. Well, thanks a lot for doing this, Jens. That was super awesome. And I wish you all the luck in your future endeavors. And I'm really looking forward to your next game.
Sounds great. I can't wait until I find out what that is.
Me neither.
Thank you very much for having me.
Again, I want to thank you for listening to this episode of Player Characters. You can find links and show notes on playercharacters.co, that's the new website, and I want to ask you a question. What's holding you back from getting a job in video games? Send me an answer to that by shooting an email on the website or contacting me through Twitter, that's @7sundk, DNK as in the letters D and K. And if you enjoyed the episode, please subscribe on SoundCloud, Apple Podcasts, or Stitcher. Once again, thank you very much.